If a man is already deeply engrossed in some other line of thought, a strong wave of thought may sweep past him without affecting him, precisely as a man already occupied in business or pleasure may not hear the voice of another speaker. As, however, large numbers of men do not think definitely or strongly except when in immediate prosecution of some business which demands their whole attention, they are likely at other times to be considerably affected by the thoughts which impinge upon them. Hence great responsibility rests upon everyone who thinks, because his thoughts, especially if strong and clear, will inevitably affect large numbers of other people. It is not too much to say that one who harbors impure or evil thoughts thereby spreads moral contagion among his fellow men. Bearing in mind that large numbers of people have within them latent germs of evil, germs which may never bear fruit unless some force from without plays upon them and stirs them into activity, the thought wave sent out by an impure or unholy thought may be the very factor which awakens a germ into activity and causes it to begin to grow. Hence such a thought may start some soul upon a downward career. This man may in a similar manner affect many others, and so the evil spreads and ramifies in countless directions. Much harm is constantly done in this way, and although it may be done unconsciously, yet the perpetrator of the evil is karmically responsible for what he has done. It is of course equally true that a beneficent thought may affect others for good in a similar manner. Hence a man who realizes this may set himself to work to be a veritable son, constantly radiating upon all his friends and neighbors thoughts of love, calm, peace, etc. Very few realize how great a force for good they may thus wield, if they choose, through the power of thought. It often happens that a man is unable to help another man physically. In fact, the physical presence of the would-be helper may be even distasteful to the sufferer. His physical brain may be closed to suggestions by prejudice or by religious bigotry. But his astral and mental bodies are far more easily impressible than the physical, and it is always possible to approach these by a wave of helpful thought, affection, soothing feeling, and so on. There are many cases where the best will in the world can do nothing physically. But there is no conceivable case in which either in the mental or astral world some relief cannot be given by steady, concentrated, loving thought. It should be noted that a thought wave does not convey a definite complete idea, but rather tends to produce a thought of the same character as itself. Thus, for example, if the thought be one of devotion, its vibrations will excite devotion, but the object of the worship may be different in the case of each person upon whose mental body the thought wave impinges. A thought wave or vibration thus conveys the character of the thought, but not its subject. If a Hindu sits wrapped in devotion to Krishna, the thought waves which pour forth from him stimulate devotion in all those who come under their influence, though in the case of a Muslim, that devotion to Allah, while for the Zoroastrian it is to Ahura-Mazda, or for the Christian to Jesus. If such a thought wave touches the mental body of a materialist, to whom the very idea of devotion in any form is unknown, even then it produces an elevating effect, its tendency being to stir a higher part of his mental body into some sort of activity, though it cannot create a type of undulation to which the man is wholly unaccustomed. A point of great importance, of which the student should take careful note, is that a man who habitually thinks pure, good and strong thoughts is utilizing for that purpose the higher part of his mental body, a part which is not used at all by the ordinary man, and is entirely undeveloped in him. Such a one is, therefore, a power for good in the world, and is being of great use to all those of his neighbors who are capable of any sort of response. For the vibrations which he sends out tend to arouse a new and higher part of their mental bodies, and consequently to open before them altogether new fields of thought. We may take the matter a little further still. A man who day by day is definitely and carefully thinking is not only improving his own thinking powers and sending out helpful thought waves into the world around him, but he is also developing and improving mental matter itself. For the amount of consciousness which can be brought into the brain is obviously determined by the degree to which the atoms of matter can respond, that is, to the number of spirally in the atoms which are vivified and active. Normally, in the ordinary physical atom at the present stage of evolution, there are four of these seven spirally active. The man who is capable of higher forms of thought is helping to develop further spirally in the atoms, and, as these atoms are continually passing in and out of his bodies, they are available for absorption and use by any other person who is capable of using them. High thinking thus helps the world's consciousness by improving the very materials of thought. There are thus many varieties of mental matter, and it is found that each variety has its own special and appropriate rate of vibration, to which it is most accustomed and to which it most readily responds. A complex thought may, of course, affect many varieties of mental matter simultaneously. The general principle, underlying the effect of thought on the mental body, and also that of feeling on the astral body, as we saw in Chapter 3, is that evil or selfish thoughts are always comparatively slow vibrations of the coarser matter, while good, unselfish thoughts are the more rapid undulations which play only in the finer matter. The power of the united thought of a number of people is always far greater than the sum of their separate thoughts. It would be much more nearly represented by their product. Hence, it is exceedingly beneficial for any city or community that there should be constantly meeting in its midst a number of people who are capable of generating thoughts at a high level. Chapter 8 Thought Forms. We come now to consider the second effect produced when a man uses his mental body in thinking, viz., the formation of thought forms. As we have seen, a thought gives rise to a set of vibrations in the matter of the mental body. Under this impulse the mental body throws off a vibrating portion of itself shaped by the nature of the vibrations, much in the way that fine particles laid on a disc are thrown into a form when the disc is made to vibrate to a musical note. The mental matter thus thrown off gathers from the surrounding atmosphere elemental essence of the mental world, that is, of the second elemental kingdom, of the appropriate type, and sets that essence into vibration in harmony with its own rate. Thus is generated a thought form pure and simple. Such a mental thought form resembles an astral or emotional form, described in the astral body, but it is far more radiant and more brilliantly colored, is stronger and more lasting, and more fully vitalized. A graphic description of the effect of thought is as follows. These mental vibrations, which shape the matter of the plane into thought forms, give rise from their swiftness and subtlety - to the most exquisite and constantly changing colors, waves of varying shades like the rainbow hues and mother of pearl, etherealized and brightened to an indescribable extent, sweeping over and through every form so that each presents a harmony of rippling, living, luminous, delicate colors, including many not even known on earth. Words can give no idea of the exquisite beauty and radiance shown in combinations of this subtle matter, instinct with life and emotion. Every seer has witnessed it, Hindu, Buddhist, Christian, speaks in rapturous terms of its glorious beauty and ever confesses his utter inability to describe it. Words seem but to coarsen and deprave it, however deftly the praise. A thought form is a temporary living entity of intense activity animated by the one idea that generated it. If made of the finer kinds of matter, it will be of great power and energy, and may be used as a most potent agency when directed by a strong and steady will. Into the details of such use we shall enter later. The elemental essence is a strange semi-intelligent life which surrounds us, vivifying matter of the mental plane. It responds readily to the influence of human thought so that every impulse sent out from the mental body of a man immediately clothes itself in a temporary vehicle of this essence. It is, in fact, even more instantaneously sensitive, if that be possible, to the action of thought than is astral elemental essence. But mental elemental essence differs greatly from astral elemental essence. It is a whole chain behind the other, and, therefore, the force in it cannot work quite in the same concentrated way. It is trying to deal with, for it is largely responsible for our wandering thoughts, as it darts constantly from one thing to another. A thought, then, as stated, becomes for the time a kind of living creature. The thought force is the soul, the elemental essence the body. These are thought forms are called elementals, or sometimes artificial elementals. The principles underlying the production of all thought forms are: 1. Quality of thought determines color, 2. Nature of thought determines form, 3. Definiteness of thought determines clearness of outline. Thought forms may be of infinite variety, both as to color and shape. With the various colors and their significance, the student will now be familiar, as they are in agreement with those existing in the astral and mental bodies as described in the astral body and also in an earlier chapter of this book. Thus, for example, affection produces a glowing rose color, a wish to heal, a lovely silver white, a mental effort to steady and strengthen the mind, a beautiful flashing golden yellow. Yellow in any of the vehicles always indicates intellect, but its shades vary much, and it may be complicated by the admixture of other colors. Generally speaking, it has a deeper and duller tint if it is directed to the lower channels, more especially if the objects are selfish. In the astral or mental body of an average man of business, it would show itself as yellow ochre, while pure intellect devoted to the study of philosophy or mathematics appears frequently as golden. This rises gradually to a beautiful clear and luminous primrose yellow when a powerful intellect is employed absolutely unselfishly for the benefit of humanity. Most yellow thought forms are clearly outlined, a vague cloud of yellow being comparatively rare. It indicates intellectual pleasure such as appreciation of the result of ingenuity, or the delight in clever craftsmanship. A cloud of this nature betokens the entire absence of any personal emotion, for if that were present it would inevitably tinge the yellow with its appropriate color. In many cases, thought forms are merely revolving clouds of the color appropriate to the idea which gave them birth. The student will realize that, at the present stage of humanity, there is a vast preponderance of cloudy and irregularly shaped thoughts, the product of ill-trained minds of the majority. It is among the rarest of phenomena to see clear and definite forms among the thousands that float about us. Where a thought is definite, a form is created, and a clear-cut and often beautiful shape is assumed. Such shapes, while of infinite variety, are often in some way typical of the kind of thought which they express. Abstract ideas usually represent themselves by all kinds of perfect and most beautiful geometrical forms. It should be remembered in this connection that the merest abstractions to us down here become definite facts, on the mental plane. The strength of thought and emotion determines the size of the thought form as well as its duration as a separate entity. Its duration depends upon the nutriment supplied to it after its generation by the repetition of the thought either by its originator or by others. If the thought be intellectual and impersonal, if the thinker is attempting to solve a problem in algebra or geometry, then his thought forms, as well as his thought waves, will be confined to the mental plane. If his thought is of a spiritual nature, if it be tinged with love and aspiration of deep, unselfish feeling, then it will rise upwards from the mental plane and will borrow much of the splendor and glory of the Buddhic levels above. In such a case its influence is most powerful and every such thought is a mighty force for good. If, on the other hand, the thought has in it something of self or personal desire, at once its vibrations turn downwards, and it draws round itself a body of astral matter in addition to its clothing of mental matter. Such a thought form, which would be termed more accurately a thought emotion form, is, of course, capable of affecting both the mental and the astral bodies of other men. This type of thought form is by far the most common, as few thoughts of ordinary men and women are untinged with desire, passion, or emotion. We may consider this class of thought forms as generated by the activity of karma manas, that is, by mind dominated by a desire. When a man thinks of any concrete object, a book, a house, a landscape, he builds a tiny image of the object in the matter of his mental body. This image floats in the upper part of that body, usually in front of the face of the man and at about the level of the eye. It remains there as long as the man is contemplating the object, and usually for a little time afterwards, the length of time depending upon the intensity and the clearness of thought. This form is quite objective and can be seen by another person possessed of mental clairvoyance. If a man thinks of another person, he creates a tiny portrait in just the same way. The same result follows any effort of the imagination. The painter who forms a conception of his future picture builds it up out of the matter of his mental body, and then projects it into space in front of him, keeps it before his mind's eye, and copies it. The novelist, in the same way, builds images of his characters in mental matter, and by the exercise of his will moves these puppets from one position or grouping to another, so that the plot of the story is literally acted out before him. As already said, these mental images are so entirely objective that they may not only be seen by a clairvoyant, but they can even be moved about and rearranged by someone other than their creator. Thus, for example, playful nature spirits, Vaidhi, the astral body, p. 53, or more often a dead novelist, watching the work of his fellow author, will move the images or puppets about so that they seem to their creator to have developed a will of their own, the plot of the story thus working out on lines quite different from those originally intended by the author. A sculptor makes a strong thought form of the statue he intends to create, plants it in his block of marble, and then proceeds to cut away the marble which lies outside the thought form until only that portion of it which it interpenetrated by the thought form remains. Similarly, a lecturer, as he thinks earnestly of the different parts of his subject, makes a series of thought forms, usually strong ones, because of the effort. If he fails to make his audience understand him, it must be largely because his own thought is not sufficiently clear-cut. A clumsy and indefinite thought form makes but a slight impression, and even that with difficulty, whilst a clearly cut one forces the mental bodies of the audience to try to reproduce it. Hypnotism provides examples of the objectivity of thought forms. It is well known that the thought form of an idea may be projected onto a blank paper, and there become visible to a hypnotized person. Or it may be made so objective that the hypnotized person will see and feel it as though it were an actual physical object. Many thought forms exist, more or less permanently, of characters from history, drama, fiction, etc. Thus, for example, popular fancy has strongly depicted characters and scenes from the plays of Shakespeare, from Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, from fairy stories such as Cinderella, Aladdin's Lamp, etc. Such thought forms are collective, having coalesced from the products of the imagination of countless individuals. Children have vivid and capable imaginations, so books read by them are usually well represented in the world of thought forms, many excellent and lifelike portraits existing of Sherlock Holmes, Captain Kettle, Dr. Nicola, and many others. On the whole, however, the thought forms evoked from the novels of today are by no means as clear as those which our forefathers made of Robinson Crusoe or of the characters of Shakespeare's plays. This, of course, is because people today read more superficially and with less serious attention than was the case formerly. So much for the genesis of thought forms. We pass now to consider their effects on their creators and on others. Each man as he moves through life produces three classes of thought forms: 1, those which, being neither centered round the thinker nor specially aimed at any person, are left behind him as a sort of trail which marks his route. 2, those, which being centered round the thinker, hover round him and follow him wherever he goes. 3, those which shoot straight out away from the thinker, aiming at a definite object. A thought form of class I, being neither definitely personal nor specially aimed at someone else, simply floats detached in the atmosphere, all the time radiating vibrations similar to those originally sent forth by its creator. If the form does not come in contact with any other mental body, the radiation gradually exhausts its store of energy, and in that case the form falls to pieces. But if it succeeds in awakening sympathetic vibrations in any mental body near at hand, an attraction is set up and the thought form is usually absorbed by that mental body. At the present stage of evolution, the majority of the thoughts of men are usually self-centered, even when they are not actively selfish. Such self-centered thoughts hang about the thinker. Most men, in fact, surround their mental bodies with a shell of such thoughts. They hover ceaselessly about them and constantly react on them. Their tendency is to reproduce themselves, that is, to stir up in the manner a repetition of the thoughts which he had previously entertained. Many a man feels this pressure upon him from within, this constant suggestion of certain thoughts, especially when he is resting after his labors, and there is no definite thought in his mind. If the thoughts are evil, he frequently thinks of them as tempting demons goading him into sin. Yet they are nonetheless entirely his own creation. He is his own tempter. Repeated thoughts of this kind play an important part in working out what is called prarabdha or ripe karma. Persistent reiteration of thoughts of the same kind, say of revenge, bring a man at last to a point which may be compared to that of a saturated solution. Just as the addition of further matter of the same kind to the solution will produce the solidification of the whole, so will a slight additional impulse result in the commission of a crime. Similarly, reiterated thoughts of helping others may, when the stimulus of opportunity touches the man, crystallize out as an act of heroism. Under such circumstances, a man may marvel at his own commission of a crime or at his own performance of some heroic act of self-sacrifice, not realizing that repeated thought had made the action inevitable. A consideration of these facts goes far towards explaining the old problem of free will and necessity or destiny. Furthermore, a man's thought forms tend to draw towards the man the thought forms of others of a similar nature. A man may thus attract to himself large reinforcements of energy from outside. It lies within himself, of course, whether these forces that he draws into himself be of a good or evil kind. Usually each definite thought creates a new thought form, but if a thought form of the same nature is already hovering round the thinker, under certain circumstances a new thought on the same subject, instead of creating a new form, coalesces with and strengthens the old one, so that by long brooding over the same subject a man may sometimes create a thought form of tremendous power. If the thought be an evil one, such a thought form may become a veritable malign influence lasting perhaps for many years, and having for a time all the appearance and powers of a real living entity. A shell of self-centered thought obviously must tend to obscure the mental vision and facilitate the formation of prejudice. Through such a shell the man looks out upon the world, naturally seeing everything tinged with its predominant colors. Everything which reaches him from without is thus more or less modified by the character of the shell. Thus, until a man has complete control of thought and feeling, he sees nothing as it really is, since all his observations must be made through this medium which, like a badly made glass, distorts and colors everything. It was for this reason that Aryasinghe, now the master Jwalkal, said in the voice of the silence that the mind was the great slayer of the real. He was drawing attention to the fact that we do not see any object as it is, but only the images that we are able to make of it, everything being thus necessarily colored for us by these thought forms of our own creation. If a man's thought of another is merely contemplative and involves no feeling, such as affection or dislike, or desire, such as a wish to see the person, the thought does not usually perceptibly affect the man whom he thinks. If, however, there is feeling, affection, associated with the thought form, built out of matter of the thinker's mental body, and this astro-mental form leaps out of the body in which it has been generated, goes straight towards the object of the feeling, and fastens itself upon him. It may be compared to a Leyden jar. The form of elemental essence corresponds to the Leyden jar, and the thought energy to the charge of electricity. If the man is at the moment in a passive condition, or if he has within him active vibrations of a character harmonious with those of the thought form will at once discharge itself upon him, and in the act cease to exist. The effect is to provoke a vibration similar to its own, if none such already exists, or to intensify it as it is already to be found there. If the man's mind is so strongly occupied along other lines that it is impossible for the vibration to find an entrance, the thought form hovers about him waiting for an opportunity to discharge itself. A thought form sent from one person to another thus involves the actual transference of a certain amount both of force and of matter from the sender to the recipient. The difference between the effect of a thought wave and that of a thought form is that the thought wave, as we saw in Chapter 7, does not produce a definite complete idea, but tends to produce a thought as the same character as itself. A thought wave is thus much less definite in its action, but reaches a far wider circle. A thought form, on the other hand, does convey a definite complete idea, transferring the exact nature of the thought to those prepared to receive it. But it can reach only one person at a time. Thus a thought wave is eminently adaptable, a wave of devotion, for example, would tend to arouse devotion in the recipient, although the object of the devotion might be quite different in the case of the sender and the receiver. But a thought form will give rise to a precise image of the being for whom the devotion was originally felt. If the thought is sufficiently strong, distance makes absolutely no difference to the thought form, but the thought of an ordinary person is usually weak and diffused, and is, therefore, not effective outside a limited area. A thought form, say of love or of desire to protect, directed strongly towards another person, goes to the person thought of, and remains in his aura as a shielding and protecting agent. It will seek all opportunities to serve, and all opportunities to defend, not by a conscious and deliberate action but by a blind following out of impulse impressed upon it, and it will strengthen friendly forces that impinge on the aura and weaken unfriendly ones. Thus are created and maintained veritable guardian angels round those we love. Many a mother's prayer for a distant child thus circles round him, acting in the manner described. A knowledge of these facts should make us conscious of the enormous power placed in our hands. We may repeat here what was said when we were dealing with thought waves, viz., that there are many cases where we may not be able to do anything for a man on the physical plane. The man's mental, and astral, bodies, however, can be affected, and they are frequently more easily impressible than his physical body. Hence it is always open to us to affect his mental or astral body by helpful thought, affectionate feeling, etc. The laws of thought being what they are, it is certain that results must accrue. There is no possibility of failure, even though no obvious consequence may follow on the physical plane. The student will readily perceive that a thought form can affect another person only if in the aura of that person there are materials capable of responding sympathetically to the vibration of the thought form. In cases where the vibrations of the thought form are outside the limits within which the person's aura is capable of vibrating, the thought form rebounds from it, and that with a force proportional to the energy with which it impinged upon it. Hence the saying that a pure mind and heart are the best protection against inimical assaults, for a pure mind and heart will construct mental and astral bodies of fine and subtle materials, and these bodies cannot respond to vibrations that demand coarse and dense matter. If an evil thought, projected with malefic intent, strikes such a purified body, it will rebound and fly back along the magnetic line of least resistance, returning to and striking its projector. He, having matter in his mental and astral bodies similar to that of the thought form he generated, is thrown into respondent vibrations, and suffers the destructive effects he had intended to cause another. Thus curses, and blessings, come home to roost. From this arise also the very serious effects of hating or suspecting a good and highly advanced man. The thought forms sent against him cannot injure him, and they rebound against their projectors, shattering them mentally, morally, or physically. When as man thinks of himself as in some distant place, or wishes earnestly to be there, the thought form, which he makes in his own image, appears in that place. Not infrequently such a form has been seen by others, and has sometimes been mistaken for the astral body or apparition of the man himself. To make this possible, either the seer must have sufficient clairvoyance for the time to be able to see the thought form, or the thought form must have sufficient strength to materialize itself, that is, to draw around itself temporarily a certain amount of physical matter. The thought which generates such a form must necessarily be a strong one, and it therefore employs a large proportion of the matter of the mental body, so that though the form is small and compressed when it leaves the thinker, it usually expands to life size before it appears at its destination. Furthermore, a thought form such as this, which must essentially be composed of mental matter, in very many cases will also draw around itself a considerable amount of astral matter. In taking on the astral form, the mental elemental loses much of its brilliance, though its glowing color may still be plainly visible inside the shell of lower matter which it assumes. Just as the original thought ensouls the elemental essence of the mental plane, so the same thought, plus its form as a mental elemental, acts as the soul of the astral elemental. None of the consciousness of the thinker would be included in a thought form such as that just described. When once sent out from him, it would normally be quite a separate entity, not, indeed, entirely unconnected with its creator, but practically so as far as the possibility of receiving any impression through it is concerned. There is, however, a type of clairvoyance rather more advanced than ordinary clairvoyance, necessitating a certain amount of control upon the mental plane. It is necessary to retain so much hold over a newly created thought form as will render it possible to receive impressions by means of it.